Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program and all of tomorrow's program, we're going to be speaking with city council candidates for the city of Santa Fe. Elections are coming up a week from tomorrow. Right now, I would like to welcome Bob Chestnut and Reverend Chester Topple. Reverend Bob Chestnut is a retired Presbyterian minister here in Santa Fe, and he's on the vision committee of the Presbytery of Santa Fe. They're looking at starting a multicultural congregation in Santa Fe, and Reverend Chester Topple is the pastor at Westminster Presbyterian Church. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
I think this is the first time we've had Presbyterian ministers, two no less, on this program. What is Presbyterianism?
Well, we could talk about it historically as one of the major Protestant denominations that came out of the Reformation of the 16th century and holds to the basic principles and beliefs that all Protestants share. Lutherans, Episcopalians also trace their history to the same period of Reformation history. Today,
what are those beliefs that all Protestants share?
Well, one is the primacy of Scripture in the formulation of Protestant beliefs. Another is salvation by grace through faith. Another, especially important for Presbyterians, is democratic church governance. That's why we're called Presbyterians, because presbyters are elders who are elected by the people in every congregation, are the governing body of each church, and are representatives to higher governing bodies of the church.
Now, when you say the primacy of Scripture, as opposed to what? Personal experience, or?
Well, as opposed to the Pope, for example, in the Roman Catholic tradition, who's the final supreme authority. For Protestants, it's Scripture.
And so various sects of Protestantism have sprung up all over the world. It's huge, huge category, Protestantism. And then Presbyterianism, is this worldwide? Is it more European, American?
It is worldwide. I think there are about 80 million members of Presbyterian and Reformed churches. Our movement began in Switzerland, spread throughout Europe, spread to Scotland under the influence of the reformer John Knox, and from Scotland to the United States. So it's a worldwide movement.
Now, the two of you became Presbyterian ministers. Is this something that tends to run in families, or did you come to Presbyterianism from a different religion?
Well, in my case, I am the first of my family to be actually clergy. But I grew up in a Presbyterian church. I was a member of a church where my great-grandparents attended, my grandparents and my parents attended.
And how did you decide to become a minister?
Interesting journey. I don't know how much would be appropriate to share at this point, but was involved in the campus ministry at Georgia Tech, which is where I studied industrial engineering. And after graduating from Georgia Tech, I interned at that campus ministry, and then I worked internationally in campus ministry in both Mexico and Santiago, Chile. And it was in Chile that I began studying theology formally at the Universidad Católica de Chile.
And what about you, Reverend Chestnut?
I had an older brother, about 11 years older, who went into the ministry ahead of me, and I grew up in a Presbyterian church home, so it's been a lifelong tradition for me. I had a spiritual awakening at age 15.
Really?
Up to that point, my ambition was to go to Harvard Law School and run for president someday.
Oh my goodness. What was the nature of that? What happened when you were 15?
Oh, that's a complicated story, but basically it was a personal experience of God's love and grace that
really
accepted me and affirmed my life no matter what, and gave me, amazingly at that age, an ability to become self-critical, see what was wrong in my life and how I needed to change it, and to find the power in prayer and Scripture to make those changes.
I often wonder, when people have a spiritual or awakened experience at a fairly young age, does it last a lifetime?
It has lasted a lifetime. There have been ups and downs and moments when I questioned what I was about and what God was about in my life. Dark nights of the soul, as some of the mystics have called it. But I, with God's guidance, found my way through that dark night and basically have never doubted my faith or my call, except for a period of time that was pretty difficult.
So you didn't go to Harvard Law School, but you did go to Harvard.
I went to Harvard Divinity School for Master of Divinity. I went to pastor my first church in Cincinnati, and then I went back to Harvard for a PhD program in religion and society.
Now, does Presbyterianism have a mystical aspect to it? It's a pretty straight ahead here and now.
Presbyterianism is a thinking person's faith, but the founder of our tradition, John Calvin's personal seal, was an open hand holding a heart aflame, which indicates, I think, that head and heart are part of our tradition. And in recent years, we have begun to discover the heart again. The mysticism of our faith goes back to the Bible, to the Apostle Paul, to John's Gospel. So, yes, there's mysticism there as well.
I could definitely attest to that. There seems to be a movement, and I think it's particularly among youth, that there's a curiosity of more than just concrete answers and hard facts, that the mystical aspect of religion is becoming quite popular. And one of our mottos in the Reformed tradition is reformed and always being reformed. And so that would constitute a kind of open spirit, we would hope at least. And so with that open spirit, there would be an openness to movements that might be influential. And so a spirituality or an idea of mysticism would be something that would be attractive if it was appropriate. So you may see trends in newer churches that are being started to have more of a mystical appeal to them.
Now, there's no heretics within Presbyterianism, are there?
Very few.
You can't be kicked out for having the wrong ideas about things?
It can happen, but it's very rare. And this openness that Chester spoke of is certainly characteristic of contemporary Presbyterianism. We're open to people who have more questions than answers about their faith. We're open to doubters and seekers. We're open to dialogue and partnership and cooperation with other Christian denominations and even other faith traditions like Muslim and Jewish and many others.
Why, you sound almost like Unitarians.
Well, we are more historically and theologically rooted in classical Christian faith than the Unitarians are. We affirm the Trinity, for example, which the Unitarians don't. That's why they're called Unitarians. But yes, we cooperate with Unitarians, talk with Unitarians, and I went to school with a lot of Unitarians at Harvard.
So you are both involved in a movement to make Presbyterianism more multicultural. It's kind of a white folks thing at this point. Is that right?
It is. Unfortunately, I guess in a large part due to just the history of this country, I'd say about nationally there's about 90% is Anglo in the U.S.
I think it's
93%. I am in minister at the church that was historically like Iglesia Segunda Presbiteriana de Santa Fe, Hispana. It was the Spanish Presbyterian Church, and it was organized in 1893. Kind of a ministry of First Presbyterian Church, which was organized a few decades earlier. At this point, we conduct bilingual services. It was decided in the 1930s to conduct all official business in English, but retaining a Spanish service. And then in the 60s, they went to one service in English and they rotated one service in English and one service in Spanish, and now we have a bilingual service. And we have a fairly decent.
So this within one service, both languages.
Within one service, right. And so we have a fairly decent representation of the northern New Mexico Hispanic or Spanish, as well as some of the newer Anglos that or traditional Anglos that reside here in this city.
Another characteristic of Presbyterianism, and Chester's reference to the history of Presbyterianism in northern New Mexico brings it to mind, is social service outreach. Presbyterians in northern New Mexico have been well known for founding schools and hospitals. Presbyterian Hospital in Albuquerque traces its roots to Presbyterian mission work. Our schools and our medical clinics are characteristic of a conviction that God calls us to serve everybody in the community around us, human need, and to have a concern about peace and justice as well in the wider world. So Presbyterians are typically social activists.
And so you're trying now to reach out even more than you have to make Presbyterian more multicultural. What does that mean? What does that look like, or what do you hope that it will look like?
We're reaching out to the growing new areas of South and South Santa Fe. The growth has been phenomenal in the past 10 to 15 years. About 5,000 homes have been built in the Community College District and Tierra Contenta. Over the next period of 10 to 12 years, more than double that number of homes are projected, for a total of about 13,000 new homes. Our studies indicate that 50 to 60% of those people are unchurched.
Unchurched.
Unchurched. People who don't attend church, who have no church affiliation. I think there is a tremendous spiritual hunger abroad today, and a lot of people who are spiritually hungry are spiritually homeless, meaning that they don't have a community of spiritual support to enable their spiritual growth and to give them vehicles for service to their community. The areas of new growth are in the Community College District more Anglo, and in Tierra Contenta more Hispanic. One area is more upper income, the other is more lower income, and we're hoping to reach both and to build a congregation that includes people of all walks of life and races and ethnicities. I've got something remarkable here I'd like to share with you and your readers if I could. It's an ad that was run in a Tulsa World a few years ago by a Catholic church in Tulsa. And I think it states beautifully our vision of an inclusive and diverse faith community. It says, "We welcome single, twice divorced, under 30, gay, filthy rich, black and proud, poor as dirt, can't sing, no habla inglés, married with pets, older than God, more Catholic than the Pope, workaholic, bad speller, screaming babies, three times divorced, passive-aggressive, obsessive-compulsive, tourists, seekers, doubters, bleeding hearts, and you."
And so you have a psychiatric clinic on the premises.
Yeah, that's a good question. What will we do with them when we get them?
We're talking to Reverend Bob Chestnut and Reverend Chester Topple of the Presbyterian Churches of Santa Fe. There's two actual Presbyterian congregations in town?
Yes.
And are they different? I mean, why two? What differentiates them? Or just one overflowed with people and you needed to build another one?
Mainly it was the history, and we could attribute it to a reluctance to try to get along with each other. That happens frequently, but during the 50s, there were two services at the First Presbyterian Church Santa Fe, which is downtown, where the what is it that's being built down there now?
The Convention Center, I think it's being called.
There was the Anglo Church, which was more of the power church, and then there was the Spanish church, which met in the basement. And in the
50s, reflected the power relations in the greater society.
Exactly. And in the 50s, the Anglo church suggested to amalgamate the Spanish church. And so with that effort, with that suggestion, the Spanish church decided to build its own church, which they built on West Manhattan in St. Francis, which was, it seems, a stone's throw away now, but at that time it was far enough away, and there wasn't much beyond where that church is located now. And so it was built in 1955, the current building where that facility is now.
So one thing that I was wondering about, when people say multicultural, sometimes that's code for multiracial. Churches, in a way, are a culture. They provide a culture. When you have multicultures within your church congregation, aren't you just asking for culture clash?
Potentially.
It certainly could be.
Yes, and it could be more than just ethnicity. It could be certainly be, as Bob has mentioned, all these things. I think classism is actually much more difficult to overcome than any kind of racism that you would confront in a multicultural church.
I agree with that totally. And from my experience of 14 years pastoring a multicultural church in Pittsburgh, which was not just racially and culturally diverse in terms of black and white, but rich and poor, urbanite and suburbanite, gay and straight, we had everything in that congregation. And it was a challenge. But we tried to recognize the diversity as a rich resource and celebrate our differences and offer a variety of styles of worship at different times during the week for people who like one thing or another. And it worked. And I know from my participation over 8 years or so in the Presbyterian Multicultural Network, which is nationwide, that it's working for an increasing number of churches, that it brings excitement and vitality and new ways of thinking and doing things when we're all the same, you know, like we wanted to be in the 50s, it can get pretty dull.
So what are some of the new kinds of things that you added? I mean, are we talking about singing and dancing?
Yes, we had one service in which, an early Sunday morning service, in which there was dancing. I don't know whether you've heard of the Universal Dances of Peace or not, but this was a frequent part of that worship service. It was informal, it was in the round, sermons were dialogical, conversations between the minister and the worshipers. So then on Wednesday evenings we had a sung service of songs from the Taizé community in France, which is very singable music, but it's kind of high church and attracted a lot of Catholics. Not because we were trying to steal the Catholics away from their own church, but because they liked it and we welcomed them there to that service.
Now, are you trying to bring people from other religions into Presbyterianism, or are you trying to attract the unchurched, or what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that we understand ourselves to be a denomination. We live in a post-denominational age, and I could go more into that if you would like. But
post-denominational age?
Right, like where denominations really are, they don't mean as much to people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Denomination came to be, when I was in college, denomination was kind of a bad word. I think the definition of it had been misconstrued. The definition of denomination is part of the whole. So being in a denomination, you recognize that you're only part of something bigger than yourself. But it came to mean, you know, competition. That's part of the spirit of the U.S., unfortunately, is extreme competition, trying to outdo others in often harmful ways. Post-denominational is kind of a movement that's very... That reflects a post-modernity type of mentality where things aren't as black and white as people might have once thought and hoped for, that there's a little bit more gray. And so with post-denominationalism, people are going to go where they feel led by the Spirit, if you want to use that language. They're going to go where they feel comfortable, where they feel that they can relate with other people. They're looking for things that are different from just, I was born Presbyterian, so I'm going to be Presbyterian for the rest of my life. So we recognize that. And so we have a particular form of church that we feel is open and could be attractive. And we're not going to say that this, you know, if you come to this church, you're going to be Presbyterian. You're going to come to this church, and if you can be filled and it can be challenging to you in your spiritual walk, then great.
To what extent is the spiritual community about theology in relationship to God and Jesus and the Trinity versus to other people, community, hanging out, having people to talk to?
It's both and. Yeah. Jesus called us to love God with heart, mind, soul, and strength. I think that calls us to a holistic response to God that involves every aspect of our being, and that's not just a individual, personal, one-on-one relationship with God, but relationship with our neighbors. Jesus called us to, first of all, love God with all our being and our neighbors as ourselves. And so part of the mysticism of our faith is what you could call body mysticism. That is, in being united to Christ in faith, we are united to each other as well, and we become his body. And that concept of the mystical body of Christ is a wonderful thing to experience when it happens.
When it happens.
When it happens.
Which is something that you can't necessarily make happen.
No, no. Paul talks about, you know, the church is the body of Christ. One person is an eye, another is an ear, another is a hand and a foot. They all have their place. What Paul didn't recognize is that in the church, the eye, the foot, and the hand each have a mind of their own. And that's a big challenge in bringing people together in faith.
So here you are in Santa Fe. Is this part of a, you know, trying to do a multicultural, multi-ethnic and so on church, Presbyterian church, do outreach? Is this part of a national movement or international movement as well?
It is. The Presbyterian Church is making it a priority to develop its future as a multicultural church.
And is that a survival thing? I mean, as we discussed yesterday on the phone, this country is headed toward having no ethnic or racial majority in the very near future.
That's right. It is a survival thing, but first and foremost, it's a faith thing. It's there in the Scripture. When God called the father of our faith, Abraham, the father of Christians, Muslims, and Jews, he said, I'm going to make your family a blessing to all the families of the earth. And Jesus, I think, reached out not so much to the privileged few, but to gather a church of a motley crew. And the book of Revelation talks about the consummation of all things with all races, nations, tribes, and tongues flowing into the consummated kingdom of God. That's a biblical vision, an ideal. I'd like to get in a few facts, if we could, before we conclude. We're having a couple of open houses. One is coming up on the 2nd at the Inn at Santa Fe near the Outlet Mall, Sunday, March 2nd, 2:30 to 4. And the second one is Saturday, March 8th, 2:30 to 4 at Miklo's Coffee House in Tierra Contenta, Jaguar Road, across from Chavez Elementary School.
Is the idea that you're going to build a new building?
No. The idea is we're going to gather a community of faith, including doubters and seekers.
Doubters and seekers. Is there a phone number that doubters and seekers can call?
They can call me at 670-9487. And they can call Chester in Spanish or English at 983-8939.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Reverends Bob Chestnut and Chester Topple. Chester's of the Westminster Presbyterian Church in Santa Fe, and Bob Chestnut is a retired Presbyterian minister. Thank you very much. This has been enlightening and fascinating.
Thank you. Got to give pleasure. A shout out to my wife and friend Kristen and Tracy traveling to New Mexico Highlands University right now.
All right. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Santa Fe City Council elections, which are coming right up. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to introduce today is the first day of 2 days in which we feature candidates for the Santa Fe City Council. The elections are on Tuesday, the 4th of March, a week from tomorrow. There are 8 city councilors in Santa Fe, 2 from each of the 4 council districts who serve for 4-year terms. And every 2 years, there's an election in which half the city council seats come up for election, 1 from each district. This year, in District 4, Councillor Matthew Ortiz is running unopposed, and I was hoping he would be on the show today, but he did not respond to my request to be on this program. And we will hear from all the candidates from Districts 2 and 3 tomorrow on this program. I would like to welcome now Councillor Patty Boucher from District 1. She's a Santa Fe City Councillor. She's running for re-election. And her opponent, Anthony Garcia, I also invited to be on this show, but he also is not going to be here. So I would like to welcome Councillor Boucher.
Good morning.
Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how did you get into politics? You've been doing this since 1994.
That's right. I had an unlikely appointment back in 1994 when Debbie Jaramillo became mayor and put me in to fill her seat in District 1. We didn't really know each other, and pretty soon thereafter, I became the worst mistake she ever made, according to Debbie.
So, really?
Apparently. I don't know, she'd like the novelty of me somehow, but the reality of me was not quite what she had bargained for.
What kind of issues did you clash on?
Well, style for sure, but really, I didn't know what I was getting into. I actually had turned down the appointment and somehow didn't manage to get to do that either. So,
you mean they just insisted that you do it, even though you didn't
want
to?
Kind of, sort of. It was a very interesting time. But I spent the first, period listening, and when I would hear something that just didn't seem right, I would just speak my truth. There were many, it goes back 14 years ago, so there were many things I'm sure I'm not remembering accurately, but I don't think we were that far apart as far as philosophy goes, in terms of really some of the issues, but really the delivery and how one, there was a little problem in terms of the use of power or misuse of power, sometimes I might say. But I think things got done, which is good, in the areas that we're focused on. And there were others that just were left to go by the wayside. So it's been a learning experience, let me tell you.
Did you, once you got into it, I mean, you spent some time listening and getting to know it, did you find that your inner political animal came out and you liked what you were doing? I mean, you must if you've been running all these years.
You know, it's funny. I don't really like politics, but I love policy making and I love public service. And I know that seems at odds because you have to be in the political arena in order to do those things. But I will tell you that, when things are crazy out there at the national level, I have found at the local level, you really can affect change. And that's what's kept me going. And it still keeps me going because there's things I want to finish. There's a couple of things I want to initiate. And then, I think that might be coming to the close of, I've given my mid-30s and now my 40s. I'm 48. So I'm looking to find some sort of resolve and we'll see from there. But, I have a really great constituency that keeps asking me to serve them. So I've enjoyed it. I love my district. I think it's a very good district for me. I live on the west side and I represent all of the northwest, and I've been able to really, I have the downtown, I have a lot of the trail connections we've been putting together, the rail yard, all very happening places, so I'm really glad to be part of it.
So what specific issues do your constituents come to you about most?
Oh gosh, they range all over the place, from a pothole to a traffic concern, which is big. I'd say they vary by the year and by the administration, and I would say right now that the delivery of basic services has been probably the biggest problem. Just,
like making water?
Well, trash pickup, street cleaning, public safety, really. I mean, the things that you would just expect to just happen smoothly have been, I'd say, this administration's the bane of their existence. It's not been easy. And it's always important to educate the voter that the policymakers, the legislators, the councillors are really not supposed to get into, micromanaging the day-to-day affairs. But all I can do, I had one constituent who was burglarized, broken into twice in 1 week over in Barrio La Cañada. And, what do you say to someone? The police say, well, maybe we can put a neighborhood watch together, but my point is, let's make sure the resources are there and the leadership is there to get the positions filled and officers on the streets and doing the right kind of decisions, making the right kind of decisions so that we're cutting down on these problems. I mean, people need to have the very, very basic right to feel safe in their homes. And that's something I'm, immediately after the election, assuming all goes well, I plan on getting together with a coalition of councillors to really try to turn things around.
There is some violent crime. There's quite a lot of domestic violence. There's rape, violence against women, a little bit of homicide, not a whole lot in Santa Fe. What do you think are the greatest threats to public safety?
Well, I hate to say it. I mean, certainly violence against women and homicides and the bad experiences we had in the spring are always on my mind and making sure we prevent them. But the day-to-day just burglaries and related to drugs, I would say, are what affect people the most. And
are most burglaries drug-related?
Again, I'm no expert, and I'm not a police chief, and I don't want to act like one. But I can say that I think there's a direct correlation when we let go of our internal narcotics unit and really weren't focusing on that for a short time. I saw crime go up in my district, in particular on the north side. I mean, there's not one area of my district that I didn't see burglaries increase.
So it looks like, even though you're not a police chief, that they are drug related.
It seems to me that there's a direct correlation, and I'd like to, you know, I know they're back on trying to really, you know, and they're working with the state police and all of that, but you know, it's filling the positions. That's a national issue. I mean, the lack of ability to fill positions and recruit officers that are already trained, because we have constant turnover. You know, it's a tough job. I'm not saying it's easy, but we have to do whatever we can to make sure that we fill the positions that we have available now, and then create more positions to get up to speed and full staffing.
What do you think is the city's role in not only policing where drugs and narcotics problems are concerned, but also preventing people becoming drug addicts in the first place?
Again, you know, not to generalize, but you know, I want to see anti-gang units. I want to see narcotic units formed. I want to see specific traffic units. I want to see really concentrated efforts. We sort of dropped the whole community policing thing as well. We have a real problem, and one of the things the council needs to do is to make sure that we continue to develop employee assistance housing. Most of our officers, our first responders, fire and police, don't live in the community they serve. That's a travesty. That's something you want to try to turn around. And we need to do that. We need to put reprioritize our resources to make sure that that's going to happen.
So you think basically that drug prevention is still essentially a law enforcement type of activity?
Oh, absolutely. It's all related. I mean, for me, it's related to also making sure our youth have things to do. You know, I mean, I've made sure that we spent $1 million in trying to complete the Warehouse 21 building because we need to have positive activities for our young people. I mean, you see it directly. We don't have any purview over the school districts, but we need to support where we can to make sure the kids are not on the streets and not, you know, getting into trouble. And, you know, it's funny. You sound like you're more and more conservative over time, but these are just basics that have to happen. I would love to not have to concentrate on those things. I would love to be able to just work on land use policies, creating more trails, making sure the rail yard is built out properly, you know, all of that. But when you have the basics, you know, that, you know, trash is not being picked up, people are not safe in their homes, those are things that we're going to have to concentrate on as a council, not get in there and act like the police chief, but make sure that they have every bit of support they need. You know, we had to enact a small property tax increase without going to the voters because it was critical that they had the resources to staff up. And, you know, we really need to continue to make sure that those are our priorities. You know, in these tight budget times, which we anticipate, given the national economy, we just need to make sure we're covering the basic delivery of services first and foremost, and then move on to the extras.
We're talking to City Councilor Patty Boucher, who is running for re-election on Tuesday, March 4th. Tuesday, March 4th is Election Day. So there's delivery of basic services, trash pickup, safety, and so on. And then there is planning. And then there's something, and we'll talk about planning for the future, things like water and so on. But then there's also things that City Council sometimes gets involved with, which is weighing in on national issues, such as war, nuclear policy, and so on. What do you think about all that?
It's interesting because the local papers tend to, you know, not think it's a positive thing. But I have to tell you that from my experience in particular, the majority of the things that we weigh in on actually have a direct impact to the city. For instance, the war. I can tell you that the resources have been siphoned off, whether it's simply the war or a variety of issues. We no longer see the kind of funding we used to see for roads, for basics that, you know, even for social services that used to so-called trickle down, they don't any longer. And so more and more you see the state or, in particular, local governments having to pick up the slack. It is not something we can really afford to do on a very extensive level.
So basically what I hear you saying is that national resources that once went to states and cities are now going to Iraq and Afghanistan and Halliburton and whatever. And so weighing in on these things is, in fact, appropriate.
Well, and even more directly, for instance, we live downstream of Los Alamos, and there are real concerns with our water company has made it clear to us that there are some cleanup issues, and it's going to impact our water supply. Now, not to sound the alarm, I mean, they they seem to have it under control. But I am concerned about water quality issues being downstream from Los Alamos, and so that is directly related to nuclear pit production and all of their likes. So if we could turn that around as well, I mean, that has to start at the top, you know, of course, but we should absolutely be able to weigh in on that, in my estimation.
When city councils all over the United States do weigh in on things, do you think it has a national effect? Are the people in Washington paying attention?
You know, I'm a big believer in from grassroots and bottom-up sort of message, and I think it's important for people to know. I mean, you see the national election right now. You see the wave. It's all not coming from the top. It's, you know, the superdelegates may in the end be the ones to weigh in at the final, but I don't believe so. I think what you're getting is grassroots, bottom-up efforts, and I really think that eventually they get the message. May not be in the timing that one likes, but it's certainly, it rises up.
When you look at the directions that Santa Fe can go, and then this gets into planning for the future, there are things that really need to be planned for. City planning and how the downtown is going to look, how the city is going to look in terms of development of housing, water, economic development. Let's talk first about economic development. What do you think are the best directions for this city?
Charlotte, we are primarily a community of small businesses. I mean, 80 to 90% of the businesses in this community are small, less than 20 employees. And I ran a small business for many years while serving on the council. And I have to say, any effort we can do to sort of develop or support or help the continuation of those small businesses. We are not going to be national recruiters. We are not going to draw very many businesses here due to our high cost of housing, our workforce development issues related to education. Those are real drawbacks to our economy. What we have is we have to play on our assets. I mean, we have to maintain a certain amount of cultural tourism, of course. And, you know, we will see a shift if there are things that happen, for instance, to the labs. But in the interim, our economic development plan, if you've probably taken a look at it, is really based on several things. I'd say primarily arts and cultural issues, and then also alternative sort of green energy and or water conservation potential. And I think if we can, because we are not somewhere that has a lot of cheap land to throw up manufacturing, it's not an economy.
We're not going to have auto truck manufacturing
no.
plants.
Well, you know, ideally we would be the design capital of the Southwest. We are really up there with arts communities like Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco. So we have a basis to start from, but we have an issue with expensive land, dirt, really. I mean, we had some publishing houses here in town for a while, but they really couldn't afford to house the books, you know, so they went down toward Bernalillo County. And so you just have to be realistic about what you have and play to your strengths. And I hope that we staff up our economic development team. It's been a little bit of a problem. There's been a lot of transition and turnover, and I really hope that we are able to concentrate our efforts on the community development that fits really well. I have a proposal that is moving along through the committee process that's supported by a nonprofit that we help fund, is Creative Santa Fe, and it's an arts center essentially on the Baca Street rail yard, and it will be not only a place to generate new creativity, but a place to display and market for artists. I mean, we are really a strong arts-based community, and I think if we can really, you know, continue to try to keep that national branding that we already have for Santa Fe. But it all goes back around, Charlotte, to the basics. Like, you know, I can't have tourists being held up by knife point in the downtown, you know, for too long without that getting back, you know, at the national level. So all of that stuff interplays, and we need to make sure that we keep Santa Fe clean and safe, and the place that generally is known as an international beautiful city to come to. So
yeah, which is both our strength and our downfall in a sense, because you know the whole world has come here and tried to buy their little acre of paradise, and then they have their second or third home here, and then they don't really become part of the life of the city.
It has changed. I have to say, we have an aging population, mostly due to the fact that we have had visitors come stay, and you know it's changed. So that's another aspect of the economic development that we need to focus on is maintaining our young people in some way, our entrepreneurship, and that goes back to the housing issues, that goes back to what is there to do at night for young people. I mean, there's so many things that...
For any people.
Well, I know, but in general, the people that are going to start up those home-based businesses. I mean, I have passed many policies back, ranging from the home occupation ordinance to Small Business of the Year Award, the ombudsman position. I mean, all of those things are an effort to recognize what our economy is based on and how we should continue to grow it and support it. And
well, there was that wonderful study that the city commissioned and that
Angelou.
Came out,
mm-hmm.
the Angelou study. When a study like the Angelou study comes out, it gets a lot of press. Do you then actually follow it and have a...
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I was referring to when I mentioned this Creative Santa Fe project over on the Baca Street rail yard. It is essentially a support system and focused in on the arts, and that is, you know, a big aspect of our economy. There are lots of other projects that we can continue. We have small business loan programs. We have great collaborations with the community college. They're actually right out in front with their programming, you know, whether it be water conservation. They're going to start a green collar sort of job programming. So we are working for sure. And, you know, I helped to put together, I earmarked a fund to make sure that we actually, because we have an economic development ordinance, but we never had a fund. And so I made sure that some of our funding goes directly there and it's put toward that. But again, we've had some transitions over at City Hall and we've had some positions unfilled and they're just getting filled. And so I have great hopes that they're going to really concentrate their efforts once again on particularly growing our local businesses and in any way they can.
We're talking to City Councilor Patty Boucher. You're working in you're the public outreach coordinator for the Water Use and Conservation Bureau of the Office of the State Engineer. That's a mouthful. But you're working basically...
Quite an acronym,
for
too.
forget it. But so you're working for the state. How do the city and state political entities interact with each other, if they do, and how could they coordinate better?
We have quite a bit of coordination with various state agencies. It's interesting. You know, it's funny, I just went off to the American Water Works Association and put a presentation together on Santa Fe's demand management programs, all the water conservation efforts, because I've been there as long as we have owned the water company, and so I've seen. But I was sent by both the state and the city. The state, for instance, in my area, has commissioned studies through contractors to really see how our water programs have been working and take a look. I mean, I think we are some of the best in this state for water conservers, the Santa Fe populace and customer base. We're really great. So they've studied us. They've helped really tweak how we calculate things. You know, there's lots of support statewide, but also... you know, we work well with the Department of Transportation. You're going to see all that coordination with the Rail Runner coming in here. We've got help with the Economic Development Department at the state level. We've got all sorts of efforts that we really do coordinate. And, of course, we depend on our legislative delegation and what we get from them. And we hopefully are going to get the money we need for our ongoing pursuit of the Buckman Directive version. So, yeah, there's a lot of good coordination.
The domestic partner bill failed once again on the in the state legislature this year. Even without that, how gay friendly is or isn't Santa Fe, and how gay friendly is or isn't the state of New Mexico?
Well, you know, you have to remember when you live up here in the bubble of Santa Fe or northern New Mexico that it's a very different state if you get below, you know, Santa Fe, essentially. And I would say, you know, clearly if we had the opportunity at the city level, we would have domestic partner classification.
But that's a state thing. You can't really do that at
the
city level.
That we can't supersede the state. Yeah. So we have written it into our Home Rule Charter, very accepting language with regard to sexual orientation. I managed to work with the previous administration to get domestic partner insurance just done administratively at the city level. But, you know, I have to tell you, it's a big disappointment when year after year you go over and, you know, it just makes no rational sense any longer. It's good for business. There are, you know, there are companies, my partner's company, for instance, is a small company, a nonprofit, but they can't get domestic partner insurance. It's because it's top down. You know, the state hasn't demanded it. It's very basic stuff that... it's so hard to, you know, I'm glad to see the governor be supportive, but there needs to be some, I think it's a generational thing to some degree, I have to tell you. I think that, you know, some folks have been in and they're really not representative of the current day of politics. I mean, look at Spain, for goodness sakes. You know, they've actually got gay marriage, and, you know, I lived there under, just after Franco had
left. We were Spain once.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just, I don't know. It feels like it's time. It's long due.
Long overdue. We're talking to City Councilor Patty Boucher. You were saying the City Council doesn't really have jurisdiction over what happens in the schools. Do you have any relationship with the school board, or do you set any policy about education in Santa Fe?
We don't set policies, but we really try to support where we can financially. And so we have made a commitment. We earmark funds for children and youth programs. We help to fund crossing guards. We often develop the school play yards. We'll, you know, loan them land for $1 a year and, you know, have a contract and develop soccer fields or play fields or playgrounds. You name it. I mean, we've had police officers in the schools before. Used to get some, that's another one of those national programs that have stopped being funded, but the COPS program that they had. We are a fiscal agent often for a variety of things. We really look to, you know, it's clear to me anyhow, who has served so long, that, you know, if we don't take care of problems early on, we see them later in some form of, you know, that we have to be reactionary, or it costs even more to, you know, society. So whatever we can do, we make efforts. We meet pretty often and try to set policies. We've been working with them lately on some of the homeless issues, because the schools had some portables that we were hoping to be able to put to use for this harsh winter we were having. But yeah, absolutely, it's important that we interact on a regular basis with the schools.
What are your proudest achievements as a member of the City Council over the 14 years that you've been involved in this?
Gosh, you know, it goes on and on, but I really...
She's opened her brochure.
Well, no, I just jogged my memory here because we couldn't even fit them all on there. There's so many things I've enjoyed working on. Let's start with the Early Neighborhood Notification Act. That was called CISO when it was first put in, but it gave the neighbors the opportunity to know what was going to come into their neighborhood.
Those big yellow signs.
Well, they turned into the big yellow signs, but what they are is a place at the table before the bulldozers really kind of start up in your area. And so I think that's been important, and it's... you know, when it was first put in, it was hailed as, oh my God, it's going to, you know, it's going to codify NIMBYs and they're not going to allow any more development. And really what it's done is, I think, taken the edge off of things and given good developers a venue by which they can communicate to the surrounding neighbors. And it's really worked out well. I've been proud of, you name it, from open space and trails. I've been the chair of the Bicycle and Trails Advisory Committee. In the last 3 years, we've managed to direct and help advise on about $6 million worth of trails that hadn't happened before. I mean, one of the policies I passed early on that required that we have bike trails on all new roads, it was just a simple change of the existing code. On economic development, I made sure that we, a myriad of things and policies, but I also made sure that we had the Economic Development Fund to actually have some funding in it. The river, I was really one of the original river advocates and helped put the river commission together, the river plan together.
Are you in favor of refilling the water?
Yes, and we have to have
water?
That discussion. But, you know, I got the river coordinator position together and the checkoff provision on your water bills. Yes, it's a dialogue we have to have, absolutely. But I am in favor of all the possibilities of putting water in the river, including the recharge possibilities. Gosh, the dog parks, you know, the first dog park, even the land for the new animal shelter. I managed to get that through the BLM for
$1
a year.
The dog park is a very good thing.
Well, I'm trying to get some more because it's overused, you know, so we've got two more now in other districts, and we're trying to get a third, another one in District 3. They've been a little slow on that.
Yes.
The night sky ordinance, got that passed.
The no smoking.
The no smoking ban, yes, for those that, you know, I know there are those that are not happy about that, but I have to tell you, I mean, we precipitated the state actually doing that, so I know it's an important movement.
I'll tell you, going dancing in a smoke-free space, even if there's rampant drinking, it's so wonderful.
I haven't seen it hurt businesses.
No.
Nor have I seen the living wage ordinance hurt businesses, and I've been supportive of that movement. I think we're a national model. Let's see. DWI forfeiture program. It's a program to try to make sure that we have, you know, all these multiple offenders in this community, and it's try to put an end to that.
The
affordable housing ordinance.
And that and much, much more we could talk about if we had more time, but we're out of time.
Okay.
Patty Boucher, thank you so much for being with us here
at
the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Me.
And Patty Boucher is a counselor from District 1, and she is running for city council once again. Her opponent, Anthony Garcia, chose not to be here with us today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Tomorrow, we have all the candidates from Districts 2 and 3, so we will be talking to them about their stand on the issues and why they're running for city council. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.